Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is, to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Sue Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dofino. You are the only case set for oral submission this afternoon. Everything else is being submitted on briefs, so you have our undivided attention. I understand both sides are ready, so if you call our sole case for the afternoon. Thank you. All right. You ready?
Well, I was reading the inscription there in front of you, Justice Dofino, and I thought you might entertain the story about how I found this case to answer their argument on the Moses argument.
Okay.
Obviously, to contradict Moses, you need something divine. And so here is the story. I was looking for a way to combat their case, and I came across a case. And normally I would research on the computer, but this one, for some inkling, I just had the notion that I should go down to the library to pull out the book. Well, I was looking at the Eckhart case here, and it turns out there was a reason for my madness. It turns out that this Eckhart case was dealing with construction in Kilgore, Texas. And not just anywhere in Kilgore, Texas, but the Kilgore Library in Kilgore, Texas. So you may have noticed that the name of my firm is Kilgore and Kilgore, and so I figured I have found the right case.
Was a divine sign.
It was a sign. I will take it as such. I hope you will too, and I hope you will be persuaded by the case. This is a situation where my client was hauled down to court here. He was up in New Jersey, working in a company up in New Jersey, and through a forum selection clause, the case was brought all the way down here to Fort Worth. They actually litigated the issue of whether or not there were sufficient contacts in order to do so, and the court up in New Jersey said, yes, we're going to send it down to Fort Worth. So the issue really, it's a plain and simple breach of contract case, or at least that's how I interpreted it to be. My guy says, well, you know, if you're going to fire me, then you got to pay me a severance. He had been working for another pharmaceutical company, was making good money, and in fact was eligible for a bonus had he continued where he was at. He gave that up upon certain promises, including promises to be eligible for a bonus if certain conditions were to be met, and promises to be paid a severance if he was discharged before the contract expired through its terms. Now, the trial court below has read the agreement very differently than my client did and very differently from what I did when I took the case. The court has looked at a couple of provisions and enforced them in a way that we do not believe they were intended to be enforced. The two principal claims here are, one is there's a bonus, and number two, there's the severance, which is the larger claim. With the severance issue, what the court below has said is there's a provision in here that says all determinations of cause will be made by the president and CEO. Now, normally, my client didn't read a whole lot into that. My client was supposed to report as a senior vice president who reported to the president. They did a bait and switch on him. When he got there the first day, he was instead assigned to the chief financial officer, and you know, at that point in time, he'd already resigned his position with another company, and so what do you do? So, but the trial court below has said this provision that says all determinations for cause are to be made by the president and CEO means that's it. That's like an arbitration clause, only with none of the protections you would get in an arbitration agreement. You don't get to say, but I did do my job. It doesn't go in front of a jury. You don't get to dispute any of that. And in fact, the trial court went one step further, because even if that had been spelled out as the intention of the parties, under New Jersey law, there's no choice of law provision. There's a choice of form, but there's no choice of law provision. So using the most immediate contacts, it would be New Jersey law that applies. Under New Jersey law, there's a doctrine up there applied in the context of employment agreements that says we're going to imply a duty of good faith and fair dealing. And so even I think that Texas law would do the same, incidentally. But under New Jersey law, New Jersey would say, look, even if you have the situation where the employer gets to call the shots, you don't get to question it. Under New Jersey law, you would then have a claim of breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. That is to say, if you could show evidence that the person who was making this decision on your job decision, had you done your job, or is this a termination for cause, or are they terminating you for some other reason? If you could show that there was an ulterior reason other than genuine job performance, then New Jersey law would say that's a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, because the expectation of the parties was that although the contract allocates to the employer certain decisions, those decisions should be made in good faith. In other words, the expectation is it would be based on legitimate performance and not something such as, we just don't like you, we don't like the way you dress, we don't like the way you talk, or the company's running short on money and we have to get rid of someone, and if we get rid of you, I can keep my bonus. That would not be in the expectation of the parties. The judge would not apply either one in this case. So the reason I spoke about the Eckert case is because the Eckert case had something similar. It's a Dallas Court of Appeals case, but it goes back to a situation where the parties are fighting over some language in a contract that says, in order to get paid, you have to get the approval of the architect. In that case, there was actually an arbitration provision, but neither side invoked the arbitration provision. The contractor said, well, you had to get our sign-off in order to get paid, and we say, no, you don't get paid, so you can't appeal it. The Dallas Court of Appeals said, no, not so fast there. Where the law implies consent has to be given, the law is going to apply a reasonable man standard. That's what they held. And there was plenty of evidence in that case that other things were going on. It turns out the issue at, was whether or not the floor was properly done, and there was some evidence that the floor was accepted, and then the foundation shifted, and that caused the floor to buckle, and they tried having someone else come do a floor, and the floor buckled again because of the foundation. And so there were fact issues as to whether or not the floor had been properly done. And the court said, no, we're not going to read a waiver of your right to put this in front of a judge and jury unless you're absolutely saying it. And we don't see that here. That's the situation we have here. There's no language in this contract that says you can't go put it in front of a judge and jury.
The trial court more relied on the Macy case, did
it? The trial court did. The Macy case is distinguishable in a couple of ways. First of all, I think it's wrongly decided, but I don't think you have to get there. The Macy case was a little bit different animal. What they said in the Macy case, the contract had a provision where there was an initial determination, and then there was essentially an appeal procedure that you could go through, much like an arbitration situation. You could go, and I believe it was to the board of the corporation, and there was a procedure spelled out that said you could put on evidence and call witnesses, and then the board would essentially provide an appeal to what the president had done. And so it's at least spelled out that there's some sort of an appeal procedure there. Keep in mind, even if there were an arbitration agreement, which is the normal way in which people opt out of the legal system, even under standard arbitration agreements, under the Texas Act, under the Federal Arbitration Act, there's always some reason for setting things aside if there's a situation of bias or inherent unfairness. Arbitration agreements can be set aside if they're inherently unfair. Arbitration agreements can be set aside if there's a showing of bias. Well, how could the person who's making the decision here, the president of the company, who gets paid based on how well the company does, how could he not be biased? That's an inherent financial bias. So even if this were read as an arbitration agreement, without any of the language that you usually see in an arbitration agreement, such as it'll be arbitrated here, all decisions will be final and binding, even if you inferred all of that, it would still be something you could set aside as an arbitration agreement because the person who's making the decision would have an inherent bias in the case. So, but we don't see any of that language. We don't see anything that says final and binding. We don't see anything that says there's some ulterior forum set up in order to ensure that a fair decision will be reached. And because we don't see that, the Eckerd case and a line of cases in our brief suggests that this is not an effective way of doing that. That if you're going to cause a waiver of rights, the right to have your claim brought down in front of a judge and jury, then what you need to do is you need to make that very explicit that that's what you're doing, that that's what you're giving up. The other issue that my client was concerned about was the failure to pay him a bonus. This is another situation where we have both the contract claim and then we also have the claim with regard to breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. The contract says you're eligible to receive a bonus. Well, what is it eligible on? Two things. Number one, there are established performance targets. And number two, you have to be here at a certain period of time when the bonus is paid. The parties agree that my client was there in terms of the first year when the bonus was paid. The issue, though, then turns on these established performance targets. Well, my client says, what established performance targets? When I read the agreement, I assumed you would give me established performance targets, and they would look like objective targets that I could then work through the year to meet. And if I met my targets, I would get paid the bonus, and if I didn't, then I wouldn't. The problem is he was never given any established performance targets. And the argument from the defendant is, well, in our mind, we decided what your established performance targets would be, and we never told you what they would be, but well, we told you to do your job, and we decided you didn't do your job, so you don't get paid your bonus. And my response to that is, well, I think that at least an implied term of the agreement is established performance targets means you're going to disclose what the targets are as conditions for you to earn your bonus. There's reason to believe that that is what was expected because there's a later provision in the same paragraph that says the company retains discretion to give you more than your bonus, your 40% of salary, if you exceed your established performance targets. Now, an explicit reservation of discretion in that form implies that if you meet your established performance targets, then you'll get paid your bonus, that it's not something that's intended to be cryptic or discretionary. It's something that's intended to be guaranteed. If you do your part, you'll get paid.
And so you're just writing out the word eligible, aren't you?
I think you can look at the word eligible and then ask the next question, which is eligible upon what? And I think that's when you start looking at the next couple of sentences, and I believe that the reasonable interpretation of the agreement would be eligible upon you've got to meet your established performance targets, and you've got to be here at the appropriate time. My guy was there at the appropriate time. They're saying he didn't perform his eligible performance targets. Well, number one, I think it's a breach if you don't share what those established performance targets is. Clearly, the point of a bonus is to give people an incentive to meet certain performance targets. I mean, that's the idea. If you do this, you will get paid an extra amount of money. Well, you frustrate the point of the bonus if you don't tell the employee what it is he's supposed to do.
Is it your position that he was terminated for cause or that he was involuntarily terminated?
He was involuntarily terminated. One of the things that they were required to do for termination for cause in the situation where it's something that's curable is they were required to make a good faith effort to actually help him cure whatever performance deficiencies he might have.
So if he's not terminated for cause, then he would not be entitled to the bonus.
If he is not terminated for cause, he would be entitled to the bonus. That would mean that's
part of the severance.
They're separate issues. But I think they go to the same issues, which was generally, did he do his established performance targets? Our response to that is he did his job duties. He was never told what those established performance targets were. If you don't tell him what the established performance targets were, then you violated the agreement and you're stopped to say you didn't do your established performance targets because you didn't tell him what they were. I think to say that there are established performance targets implies very strongly a duty on the part of the employer to spell out at the beginning, here is what I expect you to do. And if you don't do that, I think you're a stop to say you didn't later. There is the related issue, which is, did he do his job duties or was he fired for cause? But I think before you get there, even if you were to buy the lower court's interpretation of this, all decisions are made by the president, looking at the Macy case, you still have to go through the procedure in order to uphold that. And in this case, the procedure required a good faith attempt to help him correct whatever performance deficiencies there might be, not a generic listing of you didn't do these vague things. And then when he said, well, I don't understand, can you be a little more specific? You know, the agreement does say you're supposed to spell out the evidence that you're relying on to make this determination. And the response is, you're an executive, you figure it out. Well, that, at the very least, that's not in good faith. Under New Jersey law, even if they had a contractual right to say, we're not going to give you a reason, you're just fired, there would still be an obligation to exercise that decision in good faith. And where there is an affirmative obligation to spell out the reasons for termination for cause, we think good faith demands that they make a serious attempt to spell out what it is they're relying upon in order to give my guy an honest opportunity to try and correct.
I have a question. I understand there's a distinction between the grounds for the bonus and the grounds for the severance, that those are distinct issues. And I'm now talking about the severance. I'm confused. I see termination for cause, A1, failure to perform the duties, but I don't see failure to perform them well or failure to perform them to a certain level. I only see failure to perform them at all. Is there anything in the record that shows a failure or refusal to follow the directions of the company to the point that there was a failure to perform the duties at all?
I think that gets into the fact issues. As you probably noticed from reviewing the briefs, there's a vast dichotomy as to whether or not there was a failure to perform duties. I'm sure Mr. Robinson will say that, look at this long list of things he failed to do, and my response is, well, my guy says, I did do my job duties. In fact, every 2 weeks, I would sit down with Mr. Kendall, and we would talk about what are my priorities, what do you want me to do, and we would go down and get a list, and he would say, this is what I want you to focus on. And so when he comes up with this very amorphous list of stuff that he says, you're not doing your job duties because you didn't do this, he was not understanding how that could be in terms of what he, because he thought he was doing what he was being asked to do.
So y'all are not in agreement?
No.
Okay.
I guess if we were, we might not be here.
Okay.
I hope that answers your question.
Any other questions? Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. The appellee is asking that the summary judgment be affirmed, and I think starting out, it would be helpful to the court if I talked about some of the evidence, what is and is not, what the evidence does and doesn't show, what is and is not in the record. McCracken's affidavit is 718 to 728 of the record. Significantly, the McCracken affidavit doesn't identify assigned duties. The employer assigns the duties. The employee is supposed to perform the assigned duties. A plaintiff cannot show that he performed assigned duties unless he first identifies what duties were assigned. The McCracken affidavit submitted in response to no evidence and to the traditional MSJ doesn't identify his duties that were to be assigned. Since he doesn't identify them, he can't say he performed those individual duties at all. not well, but at all.
If his position is that he wasn't given the duties, a list of the duties to perform, that you say he didn't perform, I'm a little confused. If his position is he wasn't told to perform duties, specific duties, then how can he list the duties he wasn't told to perform? Do you understand what I'm asking?
I think the court's confusing the McCracken deposition with the McCracken affidavit.
Okay.
Two different animals. The McCracken affidavit fails to identify the duties. Okay? The McCracken deposition admits each and every one of the duties. That's documented in great detail in the brief. For every duty listed, I believe it's on pages 10 to 14, it shows page and line where McCracken admitted the duty, that the duty was assigned to him. What I'm talking about is the affidavit.
Right.
Puts in the affidavit, I perform my duties, and that affidavit doesn't identify the duties. That's just an inadmissible conclusion. I would also like to point out that it's McCracken's burden to show that he did perform his assigned duties, not that he just engaged in activities, but the activities had to be the activities that constituted performance of those assigned duties. If you look at page 23 of the McCracken brief, it has a list of what I would call inadmissible conclusions. I made some phone calls to unidentified people. I sent some emails to unidentified people. Don't know the subject of them or anything like that. Those are activities, but you can't tell from that if he performed his duties because his affidavit doesn't tell you what the duties are. Now, we did tell you what the duties are in the Montesol brief, but the McCracken affidavit doesn't really identify those duties.
McCracken deposition attached to summary judgment evidence?
Yes, I attached it.
Okay, so there is some evidence as to what McCracken believes his duties were.
What he admitted, yes, there are.
And in that deposition or in his affidavit, does he say he performed those duties?
He never addresses the individual duties. All you have is a conclusion. Quote, I fully perform my duties, close quote. It doesn't identify the duties. It doesn't identify the acts undertaken to perform any duty.
Not in the deposition either.
That's correct. And in the Brownlee opinion, a conclusion doesn't bar summary judgment. That's the Supreme Court ruling in Brownlee. That's just a conclusory statement that can't bar summary judgment. I would also like to point out some of the representations McCracken has made are simply incorrect. For example, at pages 29 and 23 of the brief, he claims that he brought in the Kim Farm deal, which was estimated by the company to eventually bring in $100 million. That's the quote. He cites 722 of the record. Look at 722. It doesn't support the contention. What McCracken actually did was didn't disclose to the court that the value was zero, not $100 million. The value is set forth at 307 of the record. What had actually happened is that this particular drug of Kim Farm is tied up in litigation, couldn't be sold, couldn't be used. Hadn't been sold, had zero value, and appeared to be going to be tied up in litigation forever. Another point I would like to point out is that it was referred to just a few minutes ago. The McCracken affidavit also, paragraph 18, I regularly discuss key projects with Mr. Kendall, and mutual agreement was consistently reached on priorities which I executed. Nowhere does he identify these priorities or subjects. It's just a conclusion. Nowhere is there any identification of who said what that caused McCracken to conclude agreement had been reached, and nowhere is it stated what he did to execute the duties or the priorities. It's just a conclusion, and a conclusion can't create a fact issue. One other point with regard to the evidence, I think it's worth pointing out. You just heard from counsel that McCracken said he didn't understand the cause notice memorandum. Check out the record of 378 to 380. In deposition, when asked about each item in the cause notice memorandum, he testified about it. Even when I tried to get him to go off and say it meant something else, he corrected it. He knew exactly what it meant. There is no evidence, a record, that he didn't actually understand it. After he testified in deposition about what it meant, he submitted this affidavit, which is at 723 of the record, and he tries to make a distinction between evidence and meaningful evidence. He concludes that he got no meaningful evidence, but got evidence. But he doesn't say what did he mean by meaningful, no meaningful evidence. He also talked about he didn't get a detailed description. He got a description, but didn't get a detailed description. It's just a conclusion, doesn't tell the meaning of it. And nor does it explain why he was contradicting his affidavit. And also with regard, and this goes to, again, whether or not under the bonus the performance targets were secret or not, at page 8 of the McCracken reply, it claims that the performance targets were secret. There's no cite to the record. It's not supported. At page 4 of the reply, it's claimed that under the language of the agreement, a bonus was to be awarded if he was employed on the day the bonus was paid. That contradicts the will be eligible language in the agreement. And at page 5 of the reply brief, it states that it was, quote, long after the fact when Montesol first used his duties as his 2008 performance target. The site is the 722 of the record. It doesn't support the representation in the brief. Now, in order to get a severance, there has to be an involuntary termination. There can't be an involuntary termination if there's a termination for cause. There's a termination for cause if the president, CEO, makes a determination that he didn't perform his duties. That determination was made. And there is no evidence of an involuntary termination that would provide for severance. What McCracken is attempting to do is to make the argument on the Eckhart case that when parties agree in an agreement that a particular person will make a particular decision, that you could always go into court after that. That's not the holding in Eckhart. Check out the actual language in Eckhart. The actual language in Eckhart, Eckhart is 342 Southwest 2nd, 629. At page 632, the holding in Eckhart, and also the holding in one other case, is that in derogation of the common law right to go to court, the parties may agree that a particular person will make a particular decision. But because you are giving up your right to go to court, we will not infer it. It has to be clear. It has to be express. So the question is it clear? Is it express? If it is, McCracken can't go to court over the determination of whether cause existed. If you look at the language in this particular agreement, it says all determinations of cause shall be made by the president and CEO. The word all is in there. All is inclusive. It includes everything, all decisions. It is clear. The word shall is mandatory. The word shall is clear. Quite frankly, it contravenes the agreement for McCracken to try to go around the language in the agreement after he had agreed that the president and CEO would make all determinations of calls.
How does that give him notice that he's barred from court?
How do they give him notice?
Yes, to a non-lawyer, how does that give him notice that he can't That the courthouse doors are closed to him?
By the language in the agreement. By the language in the agreement.
Just that
if it
language.
Says all determinations of cause will be made by the president and the CEO, that is notice. It's very similar to the Macy case. In the Macy case, it said any determinations of cause will be made by the board of directors.
But I read the Macy case.
Sure.
And the Macy case said, and the trial court seemed to rely on the Macy case. In the Macy case, the appellate court said the trial court decided as a matter of law that there was no breach, so any right to come to court was not waived. So that case didn't really, wasn't decided on, well, you know, they waived their right to have judicial review of the determination in that case. Isn't that what Macy said?
I think there's more to it than that specifically. Macy had an issue in whether or not they had followed their normal investigative procedures. That was in the contract, following normal investigative procedures. They said there had been no breach of that. And then, having agreed that any determination would be made by the board of directors, he was bound by that. So there are really two holdings as I read Macy, and I would encourage the court to go back and review that. I think if you look for that, you'll find that the almost exact language in that opinion. The company here has negated breach. And by that I mean the company has shown that there was cause for discharge and that unobjected to evidence. And I would just give a couple examples here. I think it would be helpful. A strategy or methodology to pick out which of the 10,000 or so drugs ought to be your optimal targets. It was assigned to Kendall. That's at 312 to 313 of the record. He didn't perform. That's at 299 and 312 to 313 of the record. There's no contradicting evidence in the record. The duty to develop a plan to get the $9 million for 2009, the revenue goal. It was his duty. That's in 364 of the record and 468. He failed to perform. That in 289 and 314 of the record. Not contradicted, other than the general statement, I perform my duties. And I do want to make one comment about the bonus. If you check the agreement, 3A and then 3B, 3B is a bonus, 3A is salary. 3A says shall pay. 3B says on the bonus shall be eligible. McCracken is coming in here asking this court to say shall be eligible means the same thing as shall pay. That violates a fundamental rule of construction that unlike language should be given unlike construction. And I would encourage the court to construe shall be eligible the way it's defined in Black's Law Dictionary and the way it's defined in Webster's. Fit to be chosen. It's no guarantee. There was no guarantee of that bonus, and the absence of a guarantee of a bonus precludes both the contract claim and the implied covenant claim because he had no right to it to begin with. And because McCracken didn't perform his duties with regard to the severance, and there's uncontradicted evidence that he didn't perform his duties, there's no contract violation, and there's no bad faith. He didn't perform his duties. That's not simply not bad faith. What this really comes down to, I think, is whether this court believes the bare naked statement, I fully perform my duties, is evidence that bars summary judgment. And I think Brownlee's dispositive. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. Is there rebuttal?
Just briefly. Needless to say, we think there's ample evidence that my client performed his duties. There's an extensive affidavit that talks about the things that he was doing. He was making, doing what you would expect a business development officer would be doing. He was trying to go out and promote the product. He was, there's descriptions of what he was doing in his affidavit. There's talking about face-to-face meetings, telephone calls, He lined up at least 70 contacts over the course of the months where he was working there. He was negotiating the Chemfarm deal, and there's a dispute here about is that a valuable deal or not. At the time, they thought it was an extremely valuable deal. They discussed their valuations. Their internal discussions of the valuation was this product was going to be worth $100 million. So, and that's in the affidavit. They talked about that. They used a valuation method by valuing the particular deal that Chemfarm had in terms of their drug with other ADHD drugs that were out there, and they said we can put together a drug combination package here worth $100 million. Now, has it actually? Well, in retrospect, no, it hasn't. And the reason for that is because there's some litigation, but that's not my guy's fault. It's not his fault that Chemfarm had issues with their patents or whatever that resulted in litigation that has slowed things down. There was anticipation that sometimes you have to go get FDA approval, and that's something else that's in the affidavit with regard to generating revenue. You can't just plop a drug out there and start getting revenue right away in all cases. A lot of times the most valuable drugs are the ones where you have to get the package delivery system with an existing or a yet-to-be-approved drug, and then you have to go to the FDA and wait a while, and then you have to do some studies. And he says, you know, you can't really evaluate whether or not someone's doing their job well in the time of that he was there simply because these larger deals, they take 6 to 9 months just to get going. So that's in the affidavit as well. Again, he was working in terms of, he did get another deal done, a Hikma deal on an existing project. That was $180,000 in revenue. He was meeting with Mr. Kendall on a regular basis. He had arranged to be co-chair and speaker at an industry conference that talked about drug delivery as a way to promote the Chemfarm, the film delivery system. So there is evidence in his affidavit that talks about the many things he was attempting to do. In terms of strategy, he said, look, we all knew what the strategy was. The strategy was you contact medical companies and drug companies, and you try to get them and persuade them that they want to partner up with Chemfarm to use this film delivery system. Everyone knew what the strategy was. So that testimony is in the affidavit as well. So we think there is ample basis in there for the court to say, look, this is just a fact issue. Let the jury hash out who they're going to believe in terms of whether or not Mr. McCracken was doing his job. He was designated as an expert. He's got 30 years in the industry. He knows what a business development a professional does in the industry. And he can testify and did testify, look, I know what a business development person is supposed to do, and I was doing it. So we think that's ample evidence. We think this is something a jury should be allowed to decide. Thank you.
Are there any questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you so much.
We appreciate you being here today. Your case is submitted, and it was very helpful having you here to answer our questions and to make suggestions to us as far as directions to do further study. So we do appreciate you coming all the way up here. And since that's it, you are free to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.